On This Week in Enterprise Tech, the next version of HTTP is focused on performance, and Google thinks they have the answer. Amazon is pitching facial recognition to ICE. There is a master key for fingerprints, and Brian, Curtis, and I talked with Stacey Levine from OutSystems around mobile platforms and low-code app solutions. Twyatt on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 317, recorded November 16th, 2018. OutSystems, low-code apps. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by DigitalOcean, the easiest cloud platform to deploy, manage, and scale applications. Over 150,000 businesses rely on DigitalOcean to remove infrastructure friction and deliver industry-leading price performance. Sign up today and receive a free $100 credit at do.co/twit. And by Command Line Heroes, a podcast from Red Hat. Listen to the epic true tales of the developers, programmers, hackers, geeks, and open source rebels revolutionizing the technology landscape. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and visit redhat.com/heroes today. And by Wasabi Hot Cloud Storage. Wasabi's disruptive cloud storage technology is helping enterprises solve one of their fastest growing issues, data storage. See for yourself with free unlimited storage for a month. Go to wasabi.com, click free trial, and use offer code ENTERPRISE. Welcome to Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that is dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and that geek who just wants to know how this world is connected. I'm your host, Louis Moreski, your guide to the big worlds of the enterprise, but I definitely can't guide you by myself. I need some help from the experts in the enterprise community, starting with our very own Mr. Brian Chee, Director of Advanced Network Computing Laboratory in Honolulu and the Geek in Paradise. Chiebert, you've been busy lately. What have you been up to?
These are some new 3D printed doodads. These are designed to hold samples in a brand new electron microscope that the university just bought. Well, just got it running. And it was 3D printed on Formlabs, and this is the new tough resin, well, newer. Oh, cool. So that it's more durable than the standard resin and so forth. So it's going to be interesting. Been doing a lot of 3D printing lately.
All the toys. You always have all the toys. Well, folks, we have not one but two experts in the field of enterprise, and we love how we're having our favorite journalist from the swamp here, Mr. Curtis Franklin, senior editor at Dark Reading. Curtis, you're Mr. Running Man lately. Congrats on all the successful races.
Oh, I appreciate it. Ran a couple of races over at Disney World, and then last weekend I supported my dear wife as she exhibited at Orlando Maker Faire, which was an incredible event. Everything from battle bots to her kind of fiber art to people doing, well, amazing things with Tesla coils. It is astounding to see just how much creativity there is out there among the making classes.
Fantastic. Well, you definitely inspire me. I need to get off my patoot and get moving a little bit. But on that note, folks, we do have a pretty inspiring show for you today as well. The next version of HTTP is focused on performance, and it's completely changing its protocol. And today we talk about how organizations might need an app for that, and they need a simple low-code way to get value out of it. And our guest from OutSystems has some solutions for you. But this week has been quite filled with enterprise tech goodness. So let's get started and jump into the blips. We've all been there. You are in the middle of a video call and things get blurry and you start to get jittery and pixelated, but you chalk it up to maybe your cell phone service signal quality. But was it? Well, David Chofness, assistant professor of computer and information science at Northeastern University, just might have the real answer for you. David developed an app called WeHe that he's been using to track how wireless carriers are treating user data in the wake of the latest repeal of net neutrality rules. Chofness and his team analyzed more than 719,000 tests conducted by 100,000 users across 135 countries and discovered that wireless carriers routinely throttle streaming video applications. Now, in the latest findings, David found that Sprint and its prepaid wireless subsidiary Boost Mobile are artificially restricting Skype performance over the company's networks. Now, this throttling occurred in 34% of a 1968 full test run between January 18th and October 15th of this year. Now, you're probably thinking, it was probably due to signal issues or network congestion. But Chofness has a different conclusion based off of his data. He did not find that throttling was limited to certain times of the day or geographic locations. He did find that throttling used a fixed bandwidth limit range shared by many users across the country, indicating that the amount of bandwidth given during throttling did not respond dynamically to congestion. Now, based on his information, it seems that Sprint's throttling does not appear to be a direct response to handling heavy network traffic. Now, Sprint responded denying this throttling, of course, of the video service. But historically, they haven't been the most trustworthy since they've been previously under fire for throttling games and music services unless users paid more. Now, how can consumers defend themselves from being throttled? Well, the FCC says it still expects ISPs to be transparent with consumers about the kind of connections they're buying. But unfortunately, those requirements are entirely voluntary and can now be ignored by ISPs without repercussions. Now, if you needed another reason to start asking your government reps to push for more net neutrality rules, let an unclear Skype call flip your bit.
Hey, remember BlackBerry? Well, the company once famous for smartphones with real keyboards announced today that it has agreed to buy endpoint security firm Cylance for $1.4 billion in cash in a deal that's expected to close before February of next year. Once a genuine smartphone powerhouse, BlackBerry has pivoted to enterprise software. The acquisition of AI-based threat prevention firm Cylance is BlackBerry's largest buy in 7 years, according to Bloomberg data, and it signifies that BlackBerry is pushing further to add security and AI to its portfolio. Now, Cylance was founded in 2012 down in Irvine, California, and it applies artificial intelligence, algorithms, and machine learning to proactively identify threats without using signatures. The idea there is to detect what it calls unknown unknowns, or zero days, at the endpoint before they cause damage. BlackBerry says that following the deal's close, it expects Cylance will operate as a separate business unit within BlackBerry Limited.
So, following up on another story, Amazon apparently is pitching its facial recognition system to the Immigration Customs the ICE. So, documents obtained through the Freedom of Information Act filed by the Project on Government Oversight, aka POGO, show that Amazon's government sales unit was actively seeking to provide the Department of Homeland Security, Immigrations and Customs Enforcement, aka ICE, Homeland Security investigations with recognition. The controversial facial recognition system. The pitch was part of a larger discussion of Amazon Web Service offerings to ICE, HSI, an offering including artificial intelligence algorithms and predictive analytics. Amazon has provided cloud services to DHS in the past, including U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. USCIS uses Amazon cloud storage to store data, including information associated with alien registration numbers, numbers also used by ICE, Customs and Border Patrol and other DHS agencies to identify and track immigrants. And DHS has also been pushing to do more in AWS. In a 2017 request for information, DHS requested information guard forward thinking, modern development, security, and operations, specifically in association with big data, analytics, person-centric, entity resolution, and machine learning to build, enhance, and support systems in large cloud environments, specifically Amazon Web Services. Well, this ought to be really interesting, and I hope to be able to report more on this.
Like many contact providers, most service-level contracts have stipulations in them that providers may change their monthly fees at any point in the term of the contract. Now, I remember dealing with this back when I had DirecTV years ago, which made me cancel and never look back at that service. Now, fast forward 7 years, and I see fees slowly creeping up on my Comcast bill as well. Well, it seems I'm not alone because Massachusetts residents are getting a refund due to the deceptions of Comcast and their contracts. Now, Comcast stuck too many Massachusetts customers with long, expensive contracts that left many in debt and others with damaged credit. Now, Comcast advertised a $99 lock-in rate, but did not adequately disclose equipment costs and mandatory monthly fees that actually would add to the monthly bills. And they failed to adequately disclose those fees that would increase that while the customer was locked in the long-term contract. Now, as a result, Comcast has agreed to pay $700,000 in refunds and cancel debts for more than 20,000 Massachusetts customers. Now, in addition to this settlement, it also requires Comcast to improve the disclosures it makes to customers before they sign long-term contracts. Now, if nothing else, this is a small win for us, the consumer, and hopefully persuades companies like Comcast to try to make money the normal way by offering good, reliable service.
Well, the stage is set for a new federal agency. Welcome to the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. A bill that reorganizes the U.S. Department of Homeland Security's National Protection and Programs Directorate, or NPPD, into a new cybersecurity agency has cleared Congress and has just been signed by the President. The Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency Act, which passed the Senate in October and the U.S. House this week, essentially redesignates NPPD as the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, or CISA. CISA will lead cybersecurity and critical infrastructure protection programs, develop associated policy, and coordinate with federal and private sector entities on security matters. CISA will also be responsible for fulfilling DHS's responsibilities with respect to anti-terrorism standards for chemical facilities. The new agency will have a cybersecurity division, an infrastructure security division, and an emergency communications division. Christopher Krebs, who's the current NPPD undersecretary, will head up the new agency. The big question is whether reorganizing NPPD into a new agency is going to make much of a difference in the U.S.'s ability to address its cybersecurity concerns. A federal bureau of cybersecurity will focus on protecting Americans as consumers and employees, and also protecting the businesses that employ them. It will be responsible for investigating and attacking cyber criminal gangs and anticipating cyber threats, but not everyone is convinced that a new agency is the answer to existing issues. Alan Paller, founder and director of research of the SANS Institute, says, quote, "I'm concerned that putting a new face on the old NPPD won't raise performance levels to what the nation needs," end quote.
So if you've been living under a rock, you might not have heard of Google Fi. But, you know, there's some really interesting new news, especially for people that want more security in their browsing. So last Tuesday, Google announced a new feature for its Project Fi cellular service, an always-on VPN. Project Fi's VPN previously was used to encrypt traffic while connecting to the network of free public Wi-Fi hotspots. But now Google will enable the VPN for all your traffic, be it over the LTE service or a Wi-Fi connection. For now, the always-on VPN will need to be turned on in the Project Fi settings, where the feature is called Enhanced Network, and it is labeled a beta feature. When you enable our Enhanced Network, all your mobile and Wi-Fi traffic will be encrypted and securely sent through our virtual private network on every network you connect to, so you'll have the peace of mind of knowing that others can't see your online activity, according to Google's blog post. They go on to say, that includes Google. Our VPN is designed so that your traffic isn't tied to your Google account or phone number. Project Fi launched in 2015 as Google's MVNO, aka Mobile Virtual Network Operator service. Fi combines services from Sprint, T-Mobile, and U.S. Cellular into a single service. It combines the best features of Google Voice with great international support and sells to customers under a flexible plan. You know, it's a cool service, but for now, it is only tied to Android and only to certain phones. I actually just looked it up this morning, and if you're running iOS, you know, if you're running an iPhone, hard luck. Hopefully, Google will say, okay, we're going to open it up to more people, but I keep hoping.
Now, biometric security just feels more secure than passwords, doesn't it? Well, have you ever thought about how systems handle impurities in the images of your face or fingers? Well, these systems have to anticipate and account for impurities in their sampling and provide a bit of wiggle room for it. Now, what if you had bad skin day or a pimple on your face? You don't want your face scan failing because of it, right? Well, you also don't want your fingerprint rejected because you touch the sensor at a slightly different angle than each time. Well, a new attack takes advantage of the flexibility programmed into these systems, generating a fake universal fingerprint. Now, dubbed Deep Master Prints, researchers have been able to create synthetic fingerprints by feeding a neural network images of real fingerprints until it could generate its own. Now, these prints were then analyzed using the same sort of verification algorithms employed by the scanners on our phones and modified over and over in subtle ways until they passed, even though they didn't actually match. Now, by repeating this with the large data set, the team was able to come up with fingerprint images that have enough elements in common with the average person's prints that scanners can readily be tricked into giving false positives. Now, here's the interesting part. A very tolerant scanner might be let through maybe 1% of false positives when using real fingerprints, but Deep Master Prints are able to fool that kind of scanner a shocking 77% of the time. Well, this just makes you start to think if convenience of using biometrics is worth giving up your security. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Next up, the bites. But first, we have to thank a really great sponsor of this week of Enterprise Tech, and that is DigitalOcean. Now, I can tell you as a developer, the ability to experiment with your apps is sometimes difficult. It's really hard to kind of get a truly hosted environment. And it's really hard to deploy to those services frequently and easily. Well, DigitalOcean removes that impedance of the cloud deployments and hosting. They make it easier than ever to deploy your applications and code and store things on the cloud without all the steps in between. I love the names that DigitalOcean gives things. They actually start with the idea of droplets, which are actually super scalable virtual machines that actually have add-on security, storage, and monitoring capabilities with just one click of a button. They also have a really great one-click deployment model that makes it easy to bootstrap your projects. You want a specific distribution of Linux? Well, just one-click deploy Ubuntu, CentOS, Debian, Fedora, and more. How about one-click deploy an application or an application stack? Well, add Docker, LAMP, MongoDB, Node.js, MySQL with just one click of a button. And not only that, it's easy to deploy. It's easy to manage as well. VM snapshots are super simple to take advantage. For me, that gives me kind of peace of mind that last known good state is always one click away. Plus, team management and unified collaboration helps your teams manage and scale your infrastructure and apps as well. Now, you need more security for your infrastructure? Well, they have one-click cloud firewalls for your droplets and droplet groups. Now, get this. The firewalls are free. Don't let that free tag fool you, because these firewalls are not just for some low-tier systems or testing environments. These things are for production ready, and they actually scale to your business in production. Now, DigitalOcean follows that great model of pay-for-play pricing. It's clear, concise, and it really helps you understand how your bill will scale with the demands of your business. Now, you want more storage? Go ahead and add more block storage to meet the needs of your application. Just $0.1 per gigabyte per month. You have to worry less about adding a peace of mind to your application, your back end. Just quickly add storage. Now, is your site starting to become popular and you need to scale it? Well, load balancers are also highly available, fully managed services that works right out of the box and can be deployed as fast as a droplet. Now, if you're like me, you love to write scripts and manage things. Now, DigitalOcean has you covered here. I'm an API guy, and I can tell you they really have some pretty great APIs that just use standard HTTP requests. Now, there are tons of reasons why you should consider DigitalOcean, but they also give you some of those extra stuff that they don't charge you for, like cloud firewalls, monitoring and alerting, full DNS management, global data centers, those enterprise-ready SSDs, and of course that API. And if you ask me, DigitalOcean has you covered. There's no reason why you shouldn't go out and try DigitalOcean right now, especially to support us here on Twyit. You can go to do.co/twit. Now, even though you're thinking about doing a project in the future, go out and get it right now, because there's over 150,000 businesses, including some of the fastest growing startups, rely on DigitalOcean to remove infrastructure friction and deliver that leading price performance. Sign up today and receive a free $100 credit at do.co/twit. That is do.co/twit for a free $100 credit. And we thank DigitalOcean for their support of this week in enterprise tech. Well, folks, let's go ahead and jump into the blips. This one is an interesting one because the industry is always looking for ways to squeeze more performance out of existing protocols that are widely used without compromising security. Well, you probably heard of HTTP. Well, there's this, of course, this new thing called HTTP 2, which is actually a rework of HTTP semantics flowing over TCP connections. The difference between the original version of HTTP was that it uses persistent connections to service multiple requests in a row, and it basically reduces the need for requests to wait on new connections. Now, the difference between 1.1 and 2.0 is that it's HTTP 2 is actually binary related, and it's fully multiplexed instead of ordered and blocking, and it can use TCP/IP connections for parallelism, and it uses header compression. Now, that second version is not without complaints because it's no longer easy to actually debug things over the wire because everything is shot over with as binary data rather than clear text. But with that revision, you still get issues with floating APEX records, hacking IPv4, 6 race conditions, and unnecessary address wastage. Now, where did HTTP 2 come from? Well, it came from Google, because I don't know if you remember hearing Google ID or the name Speedy, SPDY technology. Well, that's the basis of HTTP 2. Well, Google has added again with their HTTP over QUIC, Q-U-I-C, which actually stands for Quick UDP Internet connections. And this is literally a switch of protocols from TCP to UDP. Now, this new technology combines HTTP 2, TCP, UDP, and TLS on the UDP protocol using TCP semantics. And that's actually important because if you don't use TCP semantics, then existing systems won't be able to identify it. Now, it's encrypted by default. It uses properties of TCP connections, like reliability and feedback loops for those successful connections, without all the round trips and latency. Now, how do you do that? Well, they basically reuse the fact that there's connections to the server already, especially secured ones, and so they just reuse them. They don't actually try to renegotiate. Now, QUIC provides multiplexing and flow control equivalent to the HTTP 2. Because it's implemented on TCP, it is kind of usable out of the box to systems that already understand that protocol. And the biggest difference here is that QUIC is built on top of UDP, now, which means it doesn't suffer from some of the limitations of TCP. Now, there are Internet Engineering Task Force, or IETF, the industry group that actually collaborates and designs network protocols. They like the idea of QUIC, but they feel that they want a different revision than Google has. They want a version that really just uses HTTP 2 over the QUIC protocol. Now, Google isn't waiting. They've already started supporting this inside of Chrome 29. Opera 16 has it, as well as Lightspeed servers. And pretty much, I think Facebook's adopting it this year as well. So I'm going to bring you guys in. Jubert, I want to start with you. It makes sense that Google kind of wants to increase the speed of the web. But instituting some new protocols doesn't seem always to be the fix for these things because they're just kind of fixing the speed issues, right? They're not really wanting to fix anything else. Is this where we want the industry to go? Is just kind of, hey, let's just go keep getting faster rather than doing other things here?
Well, I'm going to ask Kevin to go and bring up that diagram from the first talking point. So this diagram actually has what the TCP basic handshake looks like. TCP has a lot of problems with it. So I don't know if you've ever noticed, say you're at a coffee shop, right, and you start trying to log in, especially if you're running an SSL, the internet service provider will go and say, okay, well, we've got less traffic going through San Francisco than through Los Angeles, so we're going to go and they start playing this game with split paths. So your data goes through one path and then comes back to you via a different path. And the problem with the splitting the paths with traditional TCP is that breaks an amazing number of protocols. So by going to UDP, a lot of things actually start happening easier. And UDP is nice because it's smaller, less overhead. I like UDP. UDP has been used as a primary transport for a lot of streaming video for a long, long time. So UDP, you can actually send things, and then it's up to the applications to recover if it's missing packets. So anyway, the thing is, UDP is more efficient. And if you're what I think Google is looking for too is when you start reducing the number of back and forth for the handshaking and you take better advantage of multiplexing, you reduce the amount of data so that when you're over metered connections, say like cellular, you can actually bring things up in a lot of more efficient. And Emily Strange does bring up, yes, voice communications. UDP is the way things go. Now, the downside, Emily, is that UDP, because it's a Hail Mary, you send it and it's up to the apps to figure it out. For voice and video, if you lose a packet, you just pixelate the picture because something's missing, but you don't resend it because you don't want to have someone walking across the screen, you know, on your movie and then suddenly jump backwards and then jump back forwards again because you've requested a missing packet that was part of that data stream. With TCP, you know, everything has to be in the right order and so forth. But UDP, your application developers have more onus on them. And that's what the Google Quick and the IETF version of Quick is all about. They're allowing you to put more of the onus on the application to figure out the missing packets and things like that for a UDP stream. Sorry, I kind of rambled a bit. But I like UDP, but this is one of those things where we're going to have to see how well Google and the IETF actually implement it, because it has some real gotchas in there. And right. Yes, Specs, no guarantee of error-free delivery over UDP for all packets. But then again, if a web page doesn't fully load, what's your initial knee-jerk reaction? You hit reload, right? So what's the difference?
Right. Yeah, I think that I was going to say that. I think that was what I was going to bring up, is UDP is kind of a throw over the wall, hope that it gets there. There's no feedback loop there. And then in this case, you know, when you're doing file transfer, sometimes you kind of want somewhat of a feedback loop somewhere, unless you're doing checksums and other things. So this should be interesting to see how they actually implement this. But because they're actually following the TCP semantics, that helps actually be compatible with a lot of the servers that are out there today. And so, Chris, I wanted to throw that over to you. Does this mean we're basically stuck on TCP because organizations, servers alike, they just understand that protocol, and it's not really easy to move the industry in a different direction. So we're just stuck on that thing going forward, basically, the semantics at least.
Well, I think we're going to be stuck with portions of it for a long time for exactly the reason you talk about. I mean, let's look at the recent history of the computer industry. We've seen in a number of different, you know, exploit waves just how long it takes to flush really old technology out of the industry. We've still got today people running Windows XP systems. We've still got people running Windows and Macintosh and other systems that are generations old. Why? Because they still work and because it costs money to replace them. So are people going to run out and replace their browsers and replace their web server software just because they could see a little bit of a speed improvement? Why, no, they're not. You know, I find it fascinating because this is addressing a piece of the puzzle that is objectively an ever smaller part of total internet traffic. You know, Cisco put out numbers back in 2016 that said that video had passed the halfway point of being all internet traffic. And in that same paper, they predicted that video would be 82% of internet traffic by 2021. To be honest, I think that most experts think that it will be there long before 2021. So this is a way to speed up a smaller portion of the overall traffic. And something else to think about when we're talking about the no error correction, a greater and greater percentage of the non-video and non-audio traffic is encrypted. It's one thing to say we're going to miss, you know, something out of the middle of a plain text email message. But what does that missing packet do for something that's hashed? What does it do for that encrypted file? Most encryption algorithms don't deal gracefully at all with incomplete payloads. So there are a lot of things that are going to have to be figured out here. I think we can play and probably profitably play with just how often we check to make sure that the received message is received with integrity. But I'm not at all sure we're ready to give up that belt and suspenders approach entirely.
Yeah, Kurt, you kind of bring this up. I mean, you're basically saying, hey, like they're focusing on one particular thing of traffic that needs to be kind of made better. Cheaper, I want to throw this to you. Is Google focusing on the right thing? Like, or should they be correcting some of the other woes and issues that these protocols have and other issues with the internet today?
I don't know. Jury's kind of out here. There's a lot of things that could work better. I'm not going to make the judgment on whether it's good or bad. But I do see a little bit of the long term. Google wants to stretch the internet to new markets. They want the third world. They want places that can't, you know, normally get to. Otherwise, they wouldn't be spending so much money on things like Google Loons and things like that. But to make those really, really long distance connections work better, they need more efficient connection protocols. You know, they can't afford to have stuff cached everywhere,
right?
Which is traditionally one of the ways you go and make things faster, you know, global load balancing. So having less back and forth for transport protocols means you can start getting it over lower bandwidth or less reliable connections into further and further distances so that it starts making more sense in the long term for the third world. So I think Google's playing a long game here, and they've obviously got the money to do it. And, you know, I worked on a startup a long, long, long time ago for basically a TCP proxy for VSAT connections. And the cost of those connections were so high that the industry, if they could get a 1% or 2% speed increase, they go and throw a party. We did some really interesting things with Squid and got, you know, our testing got a 7%. So incremental speed increases translates to a lot of money when you start talking about long distances and satellite connections and things like that. So I think, I think I like the idea. I like the direction. I'm just not sure it's the right implementation yet.
Right. Yeah, I think that's a great point. I think that, you know, we're moving to the new Wi-Fi standards, new mobile standards here, and the fact that their main focus has been on battery power and, you know, distance and speed and being able to fit more data in the pipe. And I guess this makes sense. I mean, you're adding to the protocol, you're making it do less negotiation. So that means it's going to cost less. It's going to probably use less computation and hardware resources. So I think it does make sense from that perspective. But we'll have to see. We'll have to see how it adopts and how it translates. Well, folks, that does it for the Bites. Next up is my favorite part of the show where we get to bring a guest in to drop some knowledge on the TWI riot. But before we do, we have to thank Command Line Heroes podcast from Red Hat. Now, you all know Red Hat as that open source company that's been bringing open source technologies to the enterprise for over 25 years. But Command Line Heroes layers on top of that with an original podcast that brings a set of developers, programmers, hackers, geeks, and open source rebels who are revolutionizing the technology landscape together in one show. Now, it's hosted by Saran Itbarak, whom I love. She's great. She's a developer who founded Code Newbie and lives and breathes open source. Now, Command Line Heroes takes you through the journey of living on the command line and tracking the changes that shape the world of open source development, from programming languages to learning more about supercomputers, hybrid clouds, and more. Now, there are a ton of fun topics. They truly keep you up to date on the open source landscape and the ecosystem for sure. Now, on the latest episode, you can hear about DevSecOps, teams bringing heroes together for better security. It's discussed about how bad security and reliability practices can lead to outages that affect millions. Also, discovering one vulnerability per month used to be the norm. Now, software development moves quickly thanks to the agile processes of DevOps teams. Now, Vincent Dannon shares about how that's led to drastic increases in what's considered a vulnerability. Jesse Robbins, the former master of disaster at Amazon, explains how companies prepare for catastrophic breakdowns and breaches. And also, Josh Bressers, head of product security at Elastic, looks to the future of security in tech. Now, if you haven't checked out Command Line Heroes yet, go out right now. Visit redhat.com/heroes to check it out today. Subscribe to Command Line Heroes wherever you get your podcasts and visit redhat.com/heroes for extras and to learn more. That is redhat.com/heroes. And we thank Command Line Heroes from Red Hat for their support in This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's now my favorite part of the show. We get to bring a guest in to drop some knowledge on the Twilight Riot. And today we have a really great guest. This is Stacy Levine, Director of Developer Advocacy at OutSystems. Welcome to the show, Stacy.
Thanks, Lou. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Now, anytime we talk software and software services and development, I get kind of excited and a little giddy here because that's my wheelhouse. And then you kind of sprinkle a little bit of platform as a service on top and mobile development, and you have me completely in euphoria. But before we get there, I want to our audience loves to hear kind of the people's journeys and how they started in tech. Can you maybe give us a quick journey through your kind of experiences in tech?
Sure. I started longer ago than I like to admit. Way back in the 80s with VIC-20s and things along the ways. But through my professional career, worked in lots of different industries from retail to energy to telecom to software development now. Lots of different things, web, mobile, server, backend, everything.
Fantastic. Now, OutSystems has some interesting solutions here. Now, organizations tend to not necessarily have traditional developers, to say the least. They have kind of technical individuals that first fight through technology to kind of piece it together for solutions for their organization. Now, I remember there was an interesting stat from Gartner. Now, Kevin, can you show this? That said the market demand of mobile app development services will grow at least 5 times faster than internet IT organization capacity to deliver them. Is this simply that we aren't having the skilled enough developers to be able to get organizations up to par? Like what's kind of going on in the industry?
Well, globally, there's a massive shortage of developers, right? The last numbers I saw said within the next 2 years, there's expected to be 20 million developer shortage. So not just mobile, but web, mobile, everything. Right. So it's a massive shortage. And by the way, as you know, development is fun, but it's hard. So it takes time to learn, and technology is constantly changing. So how do you keep up? How do you learn everything?
Right. So some of the things I see is a lot of organizations, like I know that Google's setting up a new platform called Flutter. There's React Native. There's Iconic. There's all these different platforms you can use that where you just have to learn simply JavaScript to kind of start building an application. But that's still kind of complex too, right? I mean, that's organizations are saying, hey, we can get some JavaScript developers, but this is still kind of a complex thing. It's still not easy enough for us to build a solution for our organization.
No, absolutely. And interestingly, I was doing some research the other day, just trying to see what the current top JavaScript front-end frameworks are. So a very specific niche. And depending on which article and which place you believe, it's one of 20 possible choices are the current top ones with different learning paths along the way. So learning one or the other, it's really, really interesting and a challenge to keep up with.
Right. Now, this is an interesting area for me because I actually come from the Power Apps group. So I can tell you that it's definitely an interesting place to be because organizations are always learning and needing a way to kind of bootstrap their development processes. Now, what kinds of things that is OutSystems trying to do here? Like what areas are they trying to target? What kind of solutions are they trying to provide?
Sure. So just taking a step back, OutSystems is a general enterprise development platform for creating web and mobile applications. business to business, business to employee, business to consumer, those are the types of applications and that we're trying to address. And it's all about speed of delivery and enabling your developers to solve problems faster.
Right. Now, before we get into it, I think you might have a video here that kind of shows some of the features. So if you want to take a look at that, we could always start that up as well. But I'm interested to see kind of how organizations kind of set that up and how they get themselves started with it.
Sure. And the video that we're going to see is, candidly, it's starting and it's creating a simple application. So it's not meant to show this is just a video, kind of a product video showing some of the screenshots. Those are screens that have been created. This is a deployment screen because OutSystems is actually not just development. It covers the entire application lifecycle.
Oh, cool.
And this is a sample mobile application that was created. And now you're looking at some development screens. So it's a visual approach to development. Which, yes, those who have been around the block are saying, hey, yeah, I've heard this before. It doesn't work, but it does. It's so different.
Maybe we could go through the technology, because this is really interesting what they're actually showing there is. Now, you can actually import your data here and then kind of map it out through the system. Like, it looks like almost like you're building almost like ladder logic there. If you were to say I have a data set and I need to build an application for that data, like a field service app or something, where do you start? Like, what do you have to do first?
So again, from my perspective, and I like to start with the data. And I think there was another video that actually showed creating an application from the start. Normally I create the data model. Whether I'm integrating with an existing database, so maybe I've got a SQL Server, Oracle, MySQL, et cetera, right? So I could have an external one, or I'm just going to start. And within the development IDE, we've got a place where you can do your traditional relational database modeling and then start creating your application from there. So for me, when I made the move to OutSystems, I didn't change my mindset on how I created applications. I create them in the same manner. I always think, okay, how am I going to start? Start with the data modeling and go from there.
That's cool. Now, is there a template-like experience? Because I know like a lot of these systems, they tend to say, hey, we know different organizations have a set of types of applications they want to build. And so we'll start them out with bootstrapping them through a template and then getting them hooked up to data that way. So do you guys actually start with templates as well?
So that is a great question. We've actually approached that a couple of different ways. So one, it's a developer tool, so I could start from scratch and go from there. But there's also productivity pieces inside of it. So I can start with some, whether I'm starting with some scaffolding patterns, which will take database tables and let you create typical show and list screens, all the way to some more advanced screen templates is what we call them. And they're really nice looking UI laid out, working screens already bound to sample data that you can quickly, easily replace so you can go forward. So we don't have full starting, hey, I need an application X, click a button and you've got application X. Everybody's different, but we've got things that accelerate your journey along the way. And we've got a really awesome UI library because UI UX is often a challenge. And if you don't have the right design of an application, then users won't use it.
Right. Now, once you kind of get that, if you do start a template or you start from scratch, now as you build out the application, you start with a data model or you might already have a data model. Does it let you map in like additional data models? Like, can you actually add to, let's say, you have a set of entities that you want to map in your application. Can you add to that as well and maybe create relations and so on and so forth?
Oh, absolutely. So the platform sits on top of a database. That database can store whatever entities you want. You can create and extend. You can tie to existing external databases. You can also call SOAP and REST. You can integrate with just about anything. That's one of the really powerful pieces of the platform. And probably one of the most common use cases is a portal or single pane of glass, bringing together data from lots of different places. Right now, I know as a developer, I also regularly got the request from the business to say, hey, I need to see a screen that shows X, Y, and Z. And they don't realize that that's coming from four different data sources, and how am I going to do all that?
Right. Yeah, I've been there, done that. So another question, so you kind of brought it up a little bit here, is, you know, obviously some CTO or somebody's going to say, hey, I need this to be in the application. So you as an IT person, you might know, oh, I know where that data is. I can go get it, and this system makes it easy for me to map it. But what about the visuals? Like, is there a way to do, like, how do you build the visuals? Is there like a designer? Or like, what do you go through the process to actually visualize that data?
Sure. So there's in the development environment, there's four main screens, right? One of the screens is data. One is logic. So this is where you would do think modules, methods, functions. And another screen is UI. So that's a WYSIWYG. Maybe that's a bad word to use, but it's a visual designer with all the standard elements, or you can adjust CSS, you can inject JavaScript, but there's a large library of existing visual components. We actually did a bunch of research, something like 2,000 applications, and distilled about 100-ish patterns. And those are reusable UI elements that are common across lots of applications out there that are now drag and drop UI elements to allow you to quickly visualize those screens or include charting or extend the platform to do the visualization that you need.
Right. Now, what about some of the other features that, like, a lot of these mobile apps come with? Like, for instance, notification support and so on. Now, you said you could write your own code, but does this kind of also provide a way for you to kind of drag and drop those capabilities into the app?
Absolutely. So let me just say again, we both do web and mobile, and on the mobile side of the house, right, we can tie into any of the native device sensors, as well as we have a place called, we call it the Forge, but it's an open source community, and we have lots of plugins. So for example, let's say you wanted to use OneSignal or PushWish or Amazon SNS to send notifications. I could go to our community marketplace, download the integration component to PushWish, set up a few keys, etc., and then start using notifications.
Very cool. Well, folks, when we come back, we want to talk a little bit more with Stacy Levine from OutSystems about mobile development and some application development for organizations. But before we do, we have to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that is Wasabi Hot Cloud Storage. Now, I have used Wasabi before, and they are pretty awesome. If you've actually used cloud storage before, sometimes it's expensive to store things in there, and especially it gets more expensive the more you perform operations on it. Well, in this day and age, the truth is that most cloud storage companies, the way they be competitive is they try to get their storage fees and their ingress and egress fees as low as they can go. But from experience, I can tell you, if you try to go cheaper on some of those services, you also give up performance and reliability as well. Well, Wasabi Hot Cloud Storage has a way to blow your mind here. If you're doing small projects all the way up to enterprise projects, Wasabi seems to have figured it all out. Now, listen to this cost: 0.49 cents per gigabyte per month, or $4.99 per terabyte per month. Plus, listen to this game changer: unlimited free egress for your data. So you don't actually pay for accessing, using API calls to access your data. Now you're probably thinking, well, if they're cheaper, they must be slower, or they don't have as many features and bells and whistles, right? Well, Wasabi has developed some disruptive technology. They found a way to pull raw performance out of their storage devices without actually compromising anything else. They have a revolutionary process that lays data on disks sequentially as opposed to in blocks. Now, if your organization's worried about compliance, Wasabi is also HIPAA, FINRA, and CJS compliant as well. Now, fast, cheap storage isn't worth much if your data isn't secure. Well, Wasabi has that answer. Wasabi offers a unique feature of what they call immutable buckets that cannot be deleted or altered, protecting your valuable data from accidental or malicious destruction. See if you can find that in any other service out there today. Now, if you're worried about data migration to the cloud services, well, Wasabi also has the answer to this as well with their Wasabi Ball Transfer Appliance. Now, this thing is powered by Netgear, and it's designed to transfer large data sets while dramatically reducing your costs. Now, you might already have cloud storage today, or your organization is trying to store data on-premise to save money, or it's partially in the cloud. But with Wasabi, you might have to rethink those approaches. Now, if you want to go try right now, go build something, move your data right now, experience Wasabi for yourself with free unlimited storage for a month. Go to wasabi.com, click the free trial link, and enter the code ENTERPRISE. See how much storing in the cloud can save your business. That's wasabi.com, and enter the code Enterprise. And we thank Wasabi for their support in this week in Enterprise Tech. We are talking with Stacy Levine from OutSystems about mobile development organizations wanting to build applications for themselves, but not always having that talent in their organization and how OutSystems is helping that. Like, I guess, Stacy, I want to go back to the quick question. We talked a little bit about, hey, like some of the add some new features to this thing. We can just kind of drag and drop them, whether they're mobile features or web features. What about security? What's offered here? Can I actually integrate it into my normal security flows? Let's say I have Active Directory or something like that. Is there a way to, is it an easy way to get those integrated in?
Sure, absolutely. So security is a very broad topic. For authentication, authorization, out of the box, you can connect to LDAP, Active Directory, right? ADFS, any SAML-based identity provider, whether you're looking at any of the major ones like Ping Federate, Okta, et cetera. So yeah, it's really easy to integrate to just about anything.
So what about, you talked about compatibility a little bit, but what about mobile platforms? You said, hey, we do web development, but we also do mobile platforms. Does it support like iOS, Android? If so, is it also support like in the store kind of apps, so you can actually build an app and deploy it to the store?
Absolutely. So the end result of mobile applications is an IPA or an APK file. So you deploy those however you deploy them now. So if your goal is to have it in the store, you deploy the app to the store just like you would typically if you're doing something in an enterprise and using an MDM, AirWatch along those lines, you just deploy it however you want. So the end result of the mobile applications is just a standard IPA APK file.
Fantastic. Well, I do want to bring my co-host back in. Brian, you're chopping at the bit here. You want to talk a little bit about trends?
So, Stacy, I'm seeing this trend that people are trying to move away from traditional development. They don't want to do, big, thick applications. I'm seeing a lot of companies not wanting to have a development team on board anymore. They want to outsource it or things like that. What kinds of pressures are you seeing in the marketplace that's pushing people into these low code development platforms?
Sure. And there are a lot of trends like what you're talking to about, but at the end of the day, most of the time it comes back to traditional IT is not often delivering as quickly as the business needs in order to stay competitive or to satisfy their needs, right? So that trend is how can you deliver more faster? Some people are calling it the consumerization of IT. We're spoiled with our mobile apps. We want to use everything. We want updates regularly. If you start seeing an app not get updated regularly, you wonder if anybody is paying attention. And that comes back to the enterprise. So all of that leads to how do we get more faster?
So one fast follow-on. Mm-hmm. When you're starting to talk to your new customers,
sure.
Who's driving this? Is this being driven from the trenches, or is this being driven from the C-suite, or is it someplace in between?
It is across the board. I've been with OutSystems just about 5 years, a little over 5 years now. And originally, it was a lot of C-suite-driven discussions, right? We have a massive backlog. How can we address the backlog? We've got 20 developers. We can't afford to hire another 80 to get what they're saying done. So that was traditionally there. Also, right, we've already touched on the proliferation of JavaScript technologies and packages alone. It's impossible to keep up with, right? If I just spent all day, every day trying to stay on top of just pick the top five front-end JavaScript technologies, I still wouldn't be able to get anything done. So the landscape is very complex. So now we're starting to see more developers going, hey, my job is hard. How do I do this better? And really, while I am a developer and that's what I do, I get, my job is really to deliver value to the business, deliver solutions. And how do I deliver those solutions and how can I make myself more valuable? And so now we're seeing more developers going towards platforms like OutSystems.
Well, Stacey, I want to talk a little bit about that platform and how it actually creates the applications that people are running.
Sure.
One of the questions that I have, you know, is this creating a standalone app, or is the OutSystem platform always there when the app is running? In other words, does this create a package that is the app, or is it more of a service that that OutSystems provides that hosts the app?
That's an awesome question. And this is when you start to see some of the differentiators between OutSystems and some of the other people in the space. So I don't want to use the bad words code generator here, because OutSystems is not a code generator in the typical sense to where you go in with something, outputs a bunch of code. Now I open up Visual Studio and start making changes, or Eclipse and start making changes to the code. OutSystems, though, the visual models that represent your applications actually do turn into standard.NET code underneath for web applications. For mobile, it's a little more complex. There's more things involved, but it's everything from React.js to SQLite to compiled server-side code there. When your applications are running, they are compiled running applications. The platform is involved in some logging, but it's not involved in interpretation or impacting your application performance at all. I mentioned also earlier, OutSystems is more than just a development engine. It covers deployment. So you've got one-click deployment to migrate between environments all the way down to containers. But to answer your specific question, the platform is in the environments, but it's not in the middle of your applications running. The applications are standard compiled applications.
Okay. Now you mentioned one of my favorite words, and that's compiled. Mm-hmm. It is with the compilation, are you compiling once and then distributing the object code, or is this one of those compile at runtime systems that so many people are fond of these days?
Well, I mentioned .NET, and just to be clear, right? So when you compile .NET code down, you're still running on top of the CLR. But so it's when you deploy the visual model and then you migrate between applications, the code gets created, it gets compiled, and then the compiled application is deployed to the various servers or server farms. Right? Mobile's a little bit different, right? And we've got a really cool mobile application build service to where you don't even have some of the challenges with creating the IPA file or APK files once you've got the code written. So there you get the IPA or APK that is built and deployed itself. Server side is compiled. So it's not doing the modeling and compiling every time. It's compile now, go. Obviously, if you make changes to your application and deploy a new build, there's a quick first time compile.
Okay, Stacey, I found on your website a case study, the mobile mm-hmm. inspector app for the city of Las Vegas. I'm going to ask our guys to play it, and we're going to do it with the sound. But feel free to talk over it if you want to highlight something. Go ahead.
Sure.
We are a population of 640,000. When we host 42 million visitors a year. So demand for online services for government has been lagging behind. And we are rapidly being asked to close that gap by our city council, our citizens, and so on. And we are obviously, like everybody else, looking to tear down those silos. So we are using a low-code, rapid delivery platform from OutSystems to do that development work. And this allows us to build feature-rich, cross-departmental applications that really work, that users are really happy with. So if you build a mobile application, it can work offline. All you have to do is flag it as offline screen, and it'll cache all the data on the front end. So if the user goes offline, he can still keep working. Our inspectors go into the field, into developing areas of the city where oftentimes we don't have cell phone towers. So they have to literally go offline and come back online, and this application synchronizes seamlessly there. So the benefits realized for us: faster proactive app delivery, 2 to 3 months versus 6 to 8 months, what we estimated previously. We cut our crew inspection times by at least 25%. Much faster work execution in the field. We've slashed our hardware, going from those clunky, ruggedized laptops to iPads, which are half the cost, at least half the cost. And low-cost platform continuously delivering new functions. So we are in a continuous improvement mode. In fact, we've had new releases continuously week after week sometimes.
So that's cool. So I think what they're saying is they basically were able to really quickly bootstrap their application development and get moving. So if, like, I guess we're running a little low on time. I wanted to ask you, Stacey, if an organization wanted to get started, where do they go? How do they get started? How easy is it for them to kind of go from data to application and get moving right away?
Sure. So if you go to outsystems.com/developers, that's a landing page with a lot of good information on how to get started. More importantly, there's a try it now link, and you can get started with a free personal environment so you can learn and do. There's hundreds of hours of online video training, and from how to build a web application to mobile, and we're constantly improving and updating it. So it's a lot of stuff is on there for free, and go and start learning. I saw some questions about how do people get started. Like, you go through the course and it takes about a week to start. I like to say to be dangerous, right? Just to start writing applications and going.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for being here. We really appreciate you being on this week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, unfortunately, we've run out of time. You've done it again. You've sat through another hour of the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe, according to 9 out of 10 mobile data visualizers. But I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially my co-host in crime, with whom I would want to do this show. Of course, I have to thank our favorite journalist in the swamp, Mr. Curtis Franklin. Curtis, where can people find you and all of your work?
Well, as always, they can find my writing over at Dark Reading. Got some interesting stuff coming up. Talked to one of the members of a new Department of Homeland Security task force. That's up today. We have some interesting stuff in next week's short week. Have to all break to give thanks latter part of the week. But beginning to work on some nice big things on AI, some things on the IoT, the mix of the two. So be sure to check out Dark Reading and follow me on Twitter at KG4GWA. Always happy to let you know when something new is ready for your edification.
Fantastic. Well, also, we want to thank our very own co-host and producer, Mr. Brian Chi. Chibert, where can everyone find you and all of your fun stuff that you're working on?
I am ADV and I'm frozen. Okay. The gods don't want me to be on the show. Can you still hear me?
Yep.
Okay. So we'll just leave me frozen. I'm ADVNETLAB at Twitter. And I'm also Chibert at twit.tv. But better yet, why don't you use Twit at twit.tv? That way it hits all the hosts. Wow, that was really weird. Anyway, I am going to try and get my hands on an Intel Neural Compute Stick, the Movius or something like that. I really, really, really want to see if I can go and teach a neural network computer to identify fish species on the underwater webcams.
Interesting stuff. Well, Curtis, Brian, thanks, guys, for being here. You guys make the show great. Well, we also want to thank you as well. You are the person that drop in each and every week to watch and listen to our show to get your enterprise goodness. We want to make it really easy for you to do so. So go out right now to twit.tv/twi. You can find all of our amazing back episodes, all the show notes, the co-host information, the guest information, and links to those stories during the show. But more importantly, next to all that video and content, you see those subscribe links to support the show by getting your audio version or video version, AC video version. Listen whatever device you want. Subscribe. Also, remember, you can always just go onto your iPhone, the iTunes podcast application, try it there as well. Also, after you subscribe, share the show with your friends because we want to be able to continue to do the show. And with your support, we can continue to do it. Now, after you subscribe, you can even check the show out live at live.twit.tv. We do it each and every week, 1:30 p.m. Pacific. Come join the show and see how the show is run in the background here. Of course, if you're going to join the show live, you want to jump into the chat room live as well because there's a great discussion always going on there. So irc.twit.tv. Now, even though IRC is a 30-year-old technology, it still allows us to connect our audiences, and we really have some great discussions. It moves the show right along and keeps up some great stuff that we're talking about there. Also, don't forget to follow me at twitter.com/luamm. If you want to see what I do in my normal job during the week, you can check out dev.office.com, where we post all the latest and greatest ways to customize your office experience and make it more productive. Now, I also want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially thank you to Leo and Lisa, who continue to support us each and every week to do This Week in Enterprise Tech. Also, to thank you to all the engineers at Twit, and also to Mr. Brian Chi, who's our loyal and tireless producer. He does all the bookings and plannings for the show. We couldn't do this show without him. Now, of course, before we sign out, I have to thank our TD for today, Kevin, Sharkman Kevin here. Tradition is, what was the main topic of the show today?
Las Vegas and how to inspect it, I think.
So close. Maybe next time. That would be low-code app development. But maybe next time, Kevin. And until next time, I'm Louis Maresca, just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep twiet.